Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora, anō, Bookends listeners. Welcome to another week with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout on your favourite New Zealand book podcast, if we do say so ourselves.
Why not? Why not?
Maureen, is it too early to start talking about Christmas?
Well, I'm reluctant to let Christmas into my life until the last moment. But I think where books are concerned, yes, let's start recommending or talking about possible gifts for people.
Because this is, after all, the last week in November that you will be listening to the show. And so, yes, the book that I'm interviewing this week would make certainly a gorgeous Christmas dream. It's called The Floral Dream, Christmas Present. There we go, I'm dreaming already. The Floral Dream by Olivia McCord. And it is the opposite of a fever dream, a floral dream. Everything is beautiful and restful and matte and lovely. And it's a book about that teaches us to grow cut flowers for appreciation.
And one of my two books is about flowers, but it is a botanical book. It's a book for people who are really interested in the New Zealand flowers, the flowers that are on our bushes and plants and trees. And being New Zealand flora, they are often tiny and hard to see. So this book is put together by a professor of botany, Philip Garnick Jones, and it is one of the most beautiful books I've seen. It comes with 3D glasses so you can see
fabulous
these flowers in their true beauty. So anyone who has a great love of New Zealand flora is going to want a copy of this book.
Two flowers books.
Yes.
Here we go.
And it's called He Pua Wai. So put that on your list. And if you want a fantastic novel to read over the Christmas period, or you want to give a novel to somebody you love who is, you know, keen on a pacey, well-written, well-crafted book, then Josie Shapiro's new novel, Good Things Come and Go, is right up there, I reckon.
Can't wait to get my hands on it. Let's go.
Everything is Beautiful and Everything Hurts was an astounding new book that came out in 2023. Josie Shapiro, the author, won the inaugural Allen and Unwin Fiction Prize with this manuscript, and it ended up being named one of the best books of 2023 by both the Spin-off and the New Zealand Listener. Josie has a Master's of Creative Writing from the University of Auckland. She was also the Sargeson Fellow in 2024, and this year was named one of 2025 New Voices of Aotearoa. She has a second book out called Good Things Come and Go. And Josie, what a sort of amazing few years you've had.
I know, it's when you read that bio, even I'm surprised. I mean, it's just been, it's been overwhelming and really wonderful, actually, the response I've had to the first book, and to have the great things come into my life, like the Sargeson Fellowship, and to be named one of the new voices. Yeah, it's wonderful.
There must be pressure associated with that as well.
I think it definitely does. The sort of the success of the first book completely exceeded my expectations. Yeah, so it was, so there was, I did feel more pressure than I had expected for the second book. The person I tried to keep front of mind and be keeping myself front of mind so that the book I created was to make myself proud first. And then I thought, if I'm proud of it, hopefully readers will enjoy it. So that tried to lessen the pressure of the many people I knew were waiting for the second book.
No. Yeah, it's, you know, success and adulation and accolades and prizes and awards. Wonderful. Of course you want them, but they come with not a downside, but they come with something else as well. I think everybody who's been waiting for this book is going to be richly rewarded. Good things come and go. Great title. You come up with good titles, Josie.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I had a few different working titles, and it wasn't until quite near the end of the manuscript that I thought maybe this one would work.
Yeah, I came across it towards the end of the book in one of the sections, and I wondered whether that at that stage you thought, this is going to work for the book.
It did. I think with every book there's always a few different titles that could work. I just my publisher liked this one. It had as well that it sort of had references to the first one, even though it's not at all related.
Yeah. No, exactly. It kind of the two books side by side kind of there's something that looks like it's continuing on. Mind you, you can break it all with the third book.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. I have a shorter title in mind for the next one.
Let's move on from titles. I'm dragging us down the title route. But when I talked to you with the first book, Everything is Beautiful and Everything Hurts, I just assumed, because a lot of it is to do with running, that you had been a runner, and you told me you hadn't. So this book, there's two sort of occupations that are very paramount. One is skateboarding, which the two males in the book are particularly good at, professional. One is a professional skateboarder, and the other is Penny, is an artist. And so there's a lot of writing about how she how she works as an artist and the actual physical painting of her work. So now I'm assuming you're going to tell me you know nothing about skateboarding or art.
What I know is only through a sort of intense curiosity that came about, you know, why the book was born. My youngest daughter, when she turned 6, wanted to learn how to skateboard, so I enrolled her in some after-school skateboarding lessons. And while I was there, these sort of quite young, ultimate risk takers with their baggy pants, they were so gentle and nurturing and taught her how to skate. And it was that unusual juxtaposition between someone who would be quite happy to skateboard down a 20-step staircase, but then also be very caring and be able to teach a young child how to skateboard. Just something about that character, those characteristics together made me think of how powerful that could be in a novel. But I do not personally skateboard. I did stand on it and it was not a good time. So I thought I'd keep my skeleton in one piece and just learn about it from the safety of my chair. And with art, no, I don't paint. I tried to apply everything I think about my own creative practice as a writer, and then tried to understand the sort of mechanics and the sort of day-to-day things of painting. Now, my maternal grandfather was a beautiful painter. He painted Australian landscapes, and I tried to think of the work that he's done as well.
Yeah, it seems to, you're writing about art and how Penny conceives of it does seem to have a deep understanding. But you're right, you don't have to be a painter to think your way into that.
Yeah, I try to think that with a lot of the things, if I don't have quite the first-hand knowledge, I try to apply an emotional truth from my own experience that can inform and sort of underpin the character's motivations.
These three characters have Penny, who's married to Adam, or are they married? No, they're not. She's his fiancé.
They're not.
That's right.
Engaged.
Yeah. And they live in LA. I'm not going to try and tell the story because you're the storyteller. They have a very close friend, Jamie. They're all sort of in their late 30s, 40-ish, and their lives are stuck. Things have kind of ground to a halt for a number of different reasons, and it's finding their way back out of what they've landed themselves into that seems to me, you know, a very essential part of this book.
I think you have sort of put the nail on the head on the main preoccupation of the three characters that they have. You know, they've got to this sort of midlife stage, and starting to realise that a lot of the roads and the paths that were open to them before maybe aren't available anymore. You know, we all come to those realizations as we grow older that the potential that we thought we had as a young person, it may not have worked out, or we might have missed out opportunity. And it's also that time when larger tragedies start to occur, the precarity of life steps in, and we realize that things aren't going to be wonderful and beautiful all the time, and how do we work our way through those moments. So it's a lot about ambition and the disappointment of missed chances. It's about friendship and how proximity and the way that we can let each other down, how that impacts throughout our lives.
These three have had a very intense relationship, you know, with each other and in various combinations of the three back when they were growing up. And you know, dramatic things have happened there, but as you say, they haven't, you know, they have been sort of potentially life-threatening, but they've managed to get out of them. I mean, if you have two young men, boys, who are doing skateboarding at the level they are, they're constantly putting themselves at risk, aren't they?
They are, you know, to learn how to do even the basic tricks on a skateboard means falling over a lot onto concrete, and it's, you know, the amount of time that's needed to execute these tricks, especially the much more difficult ones, and the risk taking, you know, the feeling that you're going to do this and you're going to do something extremely dangerous on the hopes that you might pull it off. It just takes an immense amount of bravery and resilience, and I think that that's an interesting characteristic. And I love looking at the friendship and the relationship between the two guys, and how that those characteristics to be ultimate risk takers and also to be withstanding a lot of pain, how that would play out between them.
Yeah, and Penny is there as the How would you put her? I mean, obviously both boys are in love with her, and she is torn between the two because they are different characters, even though they have a lot in common.
Yes, I was really interested, as I think, you know, a lot of people are in that idea of the triangle, the tension between that. I love the shape of a triangle. There's always that pull where all three corners are pulling from each other, and I knew that if I wanted the triangle shape, I needed a compelling third point. So there was a Jamie and Riggs, and then I knew that Penny had to be someone who they both felt an immense sort of attraction to, for both her personality and who she was and what she looked like. But the two men needed to have equally charismatic and good and bad characteristics that sort of made her unsure where to go. It was fun to play around with that structure and that sort of try and create chemistry between three characters, because it's not just about Penny, it's also the chemistry between the two men.
Yeah, and that complicates things enormously. So
yes, I it was interesting to try and write something about male friendship. I really enjoyed trying to bring something to the page that said something meaningful about that.
And it's set largely in the beginning. I mean, not in the beginning, because the book goes backwards and forwards. Their childhood, adolescence, is in Waiheke, which a lot of people will recognise and be familiar with.
I hope so. I actually ended up setting it on Waiheke for the youth because my husband grew up there for quite a long time in his childhood, and the stories that he told of what it was like in those days really intrigued me, and it felt like a great sort of setting for the kids to feel a little bit away from it all and, you know, able to get up to the whatever they wanted while they were young. It was beautiful, and it's a beautiful place, of course, and I love writing about beautiful evocative landscapes.
Yes. Well, you move them to Coromandel later on, and I'm familiar with Coromandel as well, so that it was nice for me to go back to Coromandel in my head.
Nice.
But LA, because when the book starts, it is in the kind of present day with Penny and Riggs in LA, and things have gone badly awry.
Yes, yeah, it's not a spoiler. It says it on the back of the book that that things are not going well for them, that they have lost their young daughter and Briggs is battling an addiction to painkillers. So things are really hard for them. And it's a terrible thing when people lose a young child, and how that plays out in the relationship was heartbreaking to write about, actually, to sort of think about and imagine what might go on between a couple in that situation.
Yeah, if you as a writer are putting yourself into the body of a skateboarder, an artist, and then grieving parents, it must be grueling.
It was an emotional. I try to put quite a lot of my own, try to really engage with the characters as if they're completely real. To feel what they're feeling and to really think about them and what they're going through, it is quite exhausting, actually. It's emotionally draining, but I hope that means that the characters feel more real to people when they're reading the book, and they also feel that emotional pull from the characters.
And Jamie, the third part of the triangle, he's got his own health problems. He's going blind, or he thinks he's going, well, his eyes start.
Yes, something's going on for Jamie, and he's not sure what, but he's worried for his future. And then when he's worried for his future, he's thinking, what have I done with my life? Mm. You know, what's going to be ahead for me, and what have I done? And he's alone, and he's quite a sensitive, thoughtful person. I really enjoyed writing him. I found that he was someone I was able to really. I studied philosophy in my Bachelor of Arts degree, and I was able to feel like that he was a place for me to put thoughts and feelings that and ideas that I've had ruminating on for a long time onto the page. Yeah, he's got a soft spot for Jamie.
I imagine sort of coming, you know, it all comes to a sort of an explosive end in Coromandel with the storm and the three of them together, and, you know, all this backstory suddenly dominating things. Must have been a hard story to end.
It was really hard to end. I felt like I was sort of in a car with the accelerator pressed down, and I'm trying to really push the language, push the story, and to make it feel propulsive and to make it feel like, you know, you never know what's going to happen. And then when I realized I'd got these three characters into a big tangle, it was tricky to know where the true ending could be for the three of them. And I went back and forth on a few ideas about how each character could move on from this, or where they might head. And I'm really happy, actually, with how it ends. I feel that it's one of those beautiful, well, it feels to me like a beautiful and surprising yet inevitable endings, which I think is always the best for me.
And best for the readers usually too. So thank you, Josie, for writing another absolutely astounding book.
Thank you.
I couldn't let it go, and that to me is a pretty,
so great.
Pretty good mark of good writing and a really compelling story. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. The book is called Good Things Come and Go. It's by Josie Shapiro and it's published by Allen and Unwin.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
I have not stopped raving about this particular book and since it arrived at my back door. It is called He Pua Wai. It's a natural history of New Zealand flowers and it's been written by Philip Garnick-Jones. He is a botanist, an emeritus professor and the former chair of botany at Te Heringa Waka Victoria University of Wellington. But he is obviously the man to go to talk about this particular subject. And Philip, I gather from the way you've written this book and the way it's put together that this has been an abiding interest of yours for many years.
Yes, it has. I'm primarily a taxonomist, so my research is mostly about classification and identification and evolutionary relationships of plants. But I've been heavily influenced by other people who really were the go-to people on flower biology. David Lloyd from the University of Canterbury in particular did wonderful theoretical and practical research on flowers generally. And Colin Webb, who's a contemporary of mine, also influenced me and other people that I worked with at the DSIR in Lincoln. So a lot of that's rubbed off on me, and I've done a little flower biology research myself, and some of that's in the book. Yes, it has been a long passion, and even before I was a botanist, I enjoyed flowers.
You came from England here, so what are your memories of English flowers? I don't know what age you were.
I was five, and we came out by ship. I think my only real memory of flowers is seeing drifts of bluebells in a wood in Stafford where we lived.
So New Zealand flowers, at what stage did you start noticing them? Because the thing about New Zealand flowers, apart from, you know, things like Harakeke and Pohutukawa and various others, is that they're tiny.
Yes, it's really the bird-pollinated ones that are big and showy, or most of the big and showy ones are bird-pollinated. I was lucky to grow up in Tawa, just outside Wellington, at the end of a road that ended in farmland, and there was a patch of bush there that we used to hang out in and trap possums and chop down trees and do all those things. And, it had pua wananga and it had rata and it had a lot of tawa in the forest, and it was just a wonderful place to grow up. But there was also, you know, tunneling in under the gorse and all sorts of other, you know, boyish things we did.
Yeah, and so your memories of the bush there would be, you know, as you say, a place where you could play and have adventures, but you must have been noticing what was around you.
Yes. And I remember once, my dad was keen on flowers too, and I remember he came home from work and he had a friend at work who was a naturalist, and he came home and told me that there was a New Zealand native orchid. It turns out there are actually well over 100 New Zealand native orchids, but this was the story I got as a boy. And I was in the bush and I slipped on a bank and I grabbed some vegetation and ended up looking at what I'd grabbed, and it was an orchid flower, a greenhood, a pterostylus. And I believed these things were very rare, of course, and I thought perhaps I'd discovered and pulled it up at the same time, perhaps the only one left. Turns out, no, they're quite common.
Well, just as a deviation or tangent, my attention was drawn to those tiny little onion.
Onion orchid.
The mm-hmm. onion orchids some time ago, and I now have them popping up in pots at home, and they're flowering at the moment. So it's just a joy to go to your book and read about them.
Yes, we've got them in the garden too, and they're almost weeds. I mean, of course I'm happy to have them, but they do pop up everywhere.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful little things. If you can see them magnified, they're absolutely stunning.
And that's what you've done with this book, is you've drawn our attention to all these, you know, as you say, the big bird-pollinated ones, which are there to be enjoyed and you know, take our attention. But this book draws you to look at so many different trees and bushes and shrubs and whatever, and to hunt out the flowers that are on them.
Yes, they're always worth looking at, even when they're tiny, because not everyone's got a microscope to look at them with, or even a hand lens. One of my aims was to try and convey the delight of looking through a stereo microscope at small flowers. And, you know, we're used to, as botanists, used to looking through a stereo microscope and doing dissections under the microscope. So everything's magnified, but you also see the depth and flower biology. It really is a 3D world, and it should be represented in 3D like this, I think.
So tell me about the decision to include make the photographs accessible by this little 3D viewer that you've put in with the book.
Yes, I started taking 3D photographs about probably 12 or 13 years ago, and they were pretty crummy, the early ones, and I was having to adjust my eyes to look with my right eye at the right picture and my left eye at the left picture, or even easier to swap them over and look at them cross-eyed. and so I went online looking for viewers, and I found various ones, but I think the best quality and the best price were the ones that we've got in the book. And as it turned out, I was very worried that I wouldn't be able to get them for the book. But it turned out that the company was being wound up. The owner of the company in Hong Kong is in his 80s and he was retiring. And Auckland University Press bought up his remaining stock, basically, for the book. So there won't be any more. We've got a few in reserve, but that model will be out of production. But there are others available on the net if people lose their viewer.
Yes.
And I'm also finding that cheap ways of making them. So I'm going to put something on a blog, I think, about how people can make their own viewers out of these little Fresnel lenses.
Ah, goodness.
Credit card lenses.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've made a wee viewer that works quite well. Not as well, but it's a good substitute.
But it will substitute.
Yeah.
Did Auckland University Press have to be persuaded, or were they immediately on board with the idea?
They were immediately on board, which quite surprised me, because it is a bit of a gamble on their part. I sent a few draft chapters, and Sam Elworthy, the director there, emailed me back within an hour and said, "I think we're in." So it was very encouraging.
Well, it's certainly piqued my curiosity, and since I've had the book, and because it's the right time of year, I've been going out into the garden to hunt down these tiny little, for instance, the titoki, which I've got in my garden. I've never really taken any notice of these tiny little beads. You know, they just look like little berries on the plant. And then now, having looked at your book, read about the flower and the plant, I can now go out and hunt down and see them for myself, not in the detail, of course, that's in the book, but to the naked eye, I can actually enjoy.
Mm. You can see how small and brown they are.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Tell me what it is. There's something extraordinary about our flowers, really. Our plants and their flowers.
There are a number of things that are unusual about our flowers. One of them is that we have a very high number that have separate sexes on different plants. So there are male trees or male plants and females. Most flowering plants are hermaphrodite, and most flowers are bisexual. So we have quite a lot of plants that are hermaphrodite but have unisexual flowers, and we have a lot of plants that are unisexual. The whole plant is either male or female. That's one thing. Another one is we have a lot that are pollinated by unspecialised insects like flies, and our native bees are not very specialised. And so we don't have a lot of blue flowers. We don't have a lot of strongly asymmetrical flowers. We don't have a lot of flowers with deep tubes that hide their parts or hide their nectar. Those are probably the main things. We have thought for a long time we have very few plants that are genetically self-incompatible, which means they can't self-pollinate. Well, they can self-pollinate, but they can't self-fertilise. Mm. But it turns out we haven't actually looked closely at very many, and more are being discovered. So maybe that one will not stand up to the test of time.
That's what I realised when I read your descriptions around the plants, and that's what you were talking about earlier, is that, you know, you, not you, but I mean you in general, rely on students, PhD graduates, whatever, to put their energies into researching each particular plant and flower, so that knowledge is increased.
Yes, and I've tried to highlight student work.
You have,
And I haven't had a lot of my own students have worked mostly on plant classification questions, but there has been a lot of very good student work over many years, and quite a lot of it's not published. So it gets deposited as a thesis, and then the student goes off and does something else, and the work doesn't get published, which is a shame. But there still is a lot, and a lot of good work still going on, both the academics at universities and in the government science institutes, but also their students. And it's often the students who are doing the legwork and the fieldwork and the lab work that that verifies these results and observations.
Yes, because, you know, the sexual life of plants, which is not a throwaway line, but how they reproduce is fascinating, isn't it?
It is, because plants can't move, and they can't, I mean, they can sense their environment to some extent, but they're not aware of their mates. And so they need a vector, something to carry their pollen from one flower to another. And, of course, the flower isn't aware of this process.
Just doesn't.
It happens, but it happens through natural selection, and adaptations to pollination happen through natural selection, and that's why we have so many different flowers and so many different pollinators.
I was intrigued by the idea that some plants resist self-pollination, so they have ways of protecting themselves from self-pollination.
Yes, because self-pollination is usually harmful, genetically harmful.
Yeah.
So if you're carrying a single copy of a gene that doesn't make a protein properly, for example, you can end up, if you self-pollinate or mate with a near relative, you can end up with offspring who have two copies, and then they're genetically compromised. So this is how a lot of genetic diseases work. And so flowers, as I mentioned before, self-incompatibility are kind of like an immune system, really, recognising your own pollen is one way that it's done. But also often flowers, through their timing or their spatial presentation of their parts, prevent self-pollination. And there's been a lot of argument about whether those are adaptations that specifically that prevent self-pollination, or they're doing something else. But certainly preventing self-pollination is one of the things that happens when sexual parts are separated in time or in space.
Yes, you're right, time and space. It's something that most of us, well, I shouldn't speak for everybody, but I hadn't given much thought to. you know, I look at a flax flower and I realise it's going through different stages because you can see it actually on the stem. You can see the flowers at different stages of their cycle, but I hadn't really given much thought to why it was organised that way for the the stamens and the stigma to be developing at different stages.
Yes, and it's often in something like a harakeke flower, it's often to do with the positioning of the way the pollen is dabbed on the bird's head when it probes the flower in that case. And some flowers are very precise like that. Most of our flowers are not particularly precise. They can be approached in any direction and the insects just bumble around on the surface and get themselves covered in pollen. But a few of them, like violets and the bird-pollinated tubular flowers or gullet flowers, as we call them, are often very precise in where they dab the pollen on and where the stigma picks the pollen up from.
So how did you go about, because there are 100 in here, and there's a lot more. There's 2,000 or so, aren't there? So what affected your choices in the flowers that you picked?
And what to include? Three things, I think. Firstly, I wanted to cover all the different phenomena that we see in the flora, and I've even included one that we don't see simply because it's so interesting. That's heterostyle, which is characteristic of primulas and a few other plants overseas, but we don't have heterostylous plants in our flora. So that was one to include as many of the phenomena as I could, and I think I've got almost everything in there. The second one was simply what's available to me. So there are plenty of examples of all of those phenomena, or most of them, and I just was able to grab whatever I had close to hand in the garden or in places where I could get a collection permit. And the third one, which is a bit of a major restriction, I didn't want to collect in national parks and reserves because to do that properly, you need to get a permit and permits for commercial projects. And I think, I don't know, but I think Doc would have seen this as a commercial project, are a bit harder to come by than permits for research. So I avoided collecting material anywhere where collection was prohibited. Some of the photos are taken in national parks, but they're taken of the plant in its environment and nothing was picked or disturbed.
Yeah.
That's why there aren't many alpines in the book.
No. It's interesting because I had no idea we had a sort of native hydrangea or various other.
Well, it's not a hydrangea.
But part of the family. Yes.
Well, they're not even related to hydrangeas. It's just because the leaf looks similar and the flower is blue, I think.
Yes.
A lot of common names are like that. They don't refer to a relationship so much as a similarity.
Yes, exactly. But there are so many. You've managed to pack a huge amount of information into a book that also has so many glorious illustrations.
It turns out there's a lot of information there, and a lot of these flowers I'd never seen myself until I collected them and photographed them. So I've learnt an enormous amount from this, but also dipping into the literature that I hadn't read before about each plant. And, you know, sometimes you find a huge amount, as with Pohutukawa and Harakeke, and other times there's nothing or almost nothing. So some of these flowers we don't know what visits them. Don't know whether they produce nectar or not. There's a lot of information still to be gathered.
Well, thank you for putting together this beautiful book, because I can see it appealing to people on just about every level. You either just look at the lovely photographs, use your 3D viewer to have them come alive in front of you, or you pick and choose and read about the flowers and plants that you are interested in, or you read the whole book and discover so many different pieces of information about what's around us, the natural world of our plants.
Exactly, yes. I hope people will enjoy it on all of those levels. that was really something that I had in mind, and was brought out beautifully by the designer, Duncan Munro, who has done a fabulous job in turning my words and pictures into a beautiful book. All credit to him for that. It's a wonderful piece of work from his part.
Mm. Well, a marvellous collaboration. The book is called He Pua Wai, A Natural History of New Zealand Flowers. It's by Philip Garnick-Jones and published magnificently by Auckland University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Olivia McCord wants us all to experience the pleasure of growing cut flowers. She boldly says, with the right guidance, anyone can cultivate stunning blooms, and has written precisely the book of guidance needed. It's beautiful, and it's a perfect moody Christchurch late spring morning in the rain for a chat about floral dreams. Tēnā koe, Olivia. Lovely to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. Whereabouts are you? You're not in Christchurch in the misty morning?
No, I'm in Tauranga. Right. And it was a big storm last night, but I'm looking out my office window and the sun's starting to peek through now.
Okay, and your flowers aren't too beaten up by last night's storm?
No, they actually held together quite well, surprisingly.
Pleased to hear it. But so tell us, Olivia, flowers weren't your first career choice.
No.
So give the readers, the listeners, a little bit of your story. Where did your passion for flowers come from?
Well, I think probably if you go right back to my childhood, I had a British mother. So we used to go to England every second year to go visit the family. So, and she took us to all the stately homes.
Right.
And they had all the huge herbaceous borders. So I think there was part of that kind of formed my love for those more floral English style gardens. But gardening really wasn't a focus for me at all. I was more interested in fashion, and I went to university and got a marketing degree. And because at the time I thought to be creative, you had to be able to draw. Mm. As a teenager, that's the only way I thought you could be creative, was an artist, and I can't draw at all. So I thought, oh, well, if I work in the fashion industry and I can go in the business side of it. And I started working in Auckland after uni in fashion, did my OE, but it didn't quite fit for me. Like, I enjoyed it, but it didn't feel a perfect fit. And then I retrained when I moved to Tauranga, because there's not a huge fashion marketing scene in Tauranga.
Okay, not dissing Tauranga remotely, but I hear that.
None of the head offices for those kind of places really are located here.
And it's so perfect. Retrained. It's a perfect horticultural environment.
Oh, perfect growing environment. But I retrained as a teacher and then had kids myself, and we moved out onto a block of land because we wanted to raise our children in the country, and we developed, being in Tauranga, a kiwifruit orchard. So that's the main, I guess, horticulture activity in Tauranga is. And I learned a lot about growing, and I just started making huge gardens myself. And then with two young children, I didn't really want to go back into the workforce where I couldn't juggle around their needs. So I wanted to start my own business. And so with no experience at all and no real knowledge, I just decided to start an edible flower farm one day.
Right.
And that's kind of how I started in flowers.
So thinking that edible flowers for the restaurant market was a gap that you thought you could fill.
Yeah.
And so...
And also, you don't need a stem for edible flowers. You just need the head. So for me, as a novice grower, that seemed a lot more achievable, because it didn't. If I grew wonky stems or short stems, it didn't really matter.
Okay. Well, I mean, but even there, that's a little bit of insight around the market that you're serving, isn't it? And what's challenging about growing flowers. I didn't know that stems were part of what was challenging about growing flowers. So you obviously came with a little bit of floral appreciation anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting to me just listening to that, because the book is both, it's kind of a gardening book, but it's not really a gardening book like you might expect, eh? Not like it's not about herbaceous borders, for example. Because despite what you might think when you think about flowers, the goal isn't actually, for this book, isn't about getting beds or a garden layout that looks all gorgeous.
No.
It's a book about producing and then enjoying flowers.
Probably more similar to what you would imagine, like vegetable books.
That's exactly what I put down here. And it's because it's also got almost like a recipe section at the back. It's like a vegetable gardening book with recipes, but it's for flowers. Was the analogy I was coming through. So, listeners, if you want to grow flowers and then enjoy them, this is a very beautiful book for you. Is it a book that you wish you had when you said about establishing your own cut flower business? Yeah, okay.
So I went on a deep dive. Having not come from a gardening background, I didn't know the names of things. And I was quite embarrassed, you know, to ask people, because I didn't know what an annual or perennial even meant when I started. And, you know, you kind of don't want to go out and say to people, what does this mean? I've started a flower farm, but I don't know what any of it means. So I did a lot of my own research. I actually ended up going and studying horticulture extramurally. And I was searching for just a place where all the information was accessible, not off-putting with lots of technical detail, but mainly to our climate, because most of the books I found were for the Northern Hemisphere. You know, it was either England or America, and they've got plants we don't have. None of the growing calendars meant anything. They do kind of different things, you know, like in the American books, it was all about growing pumpkins for your arrangement. We don't do that in New Zealand.
Okay, no.
It was just quite different.
Yeah, no, lovely. So that was the impression I got, was that it's a book that you were writing almost to capture and catalogue all of the knowledge that you had gained. Was there anything that you came across? What's kind of like the book family that you think that this book belongs in? Other guides that you've loved? Or is it really the first one that you've come across that does this for cut flowers?
No, I mean, anyone in the flower world would have heard of, now I'm going to say her surname wrong, I'll just say her first name, Erin, and then it's a hard surname, it starts with B. But she is an American, and she has Florette Farms, and she's got her own cut flower book, and she runs courses on Instagram. She's huge, and she was kind of self-taught and made as well. And she just her story kind of inspired me, because she was a young mum on land, the same as me. And I guess she has her books, I think, The Cut Flower Farm. So that was a really good kind of
And so you've
basis.
Got, you've also referenced, it's what's interesting is a whole lot of Instagram references at the back. And so this different kind of world now available to people who are learning. This is a beautiful book, but there's all of this other learning material available online that you reference very generously at the back of the book as kind of how you gained a lot of your knowledge.
Yeah, and I think for me, transitioning into the gardening world, I think when I used to work in beauty and fashion and the marketing, it was quite competitive, you know, against your competitors. You didn't really share information between each other, and that has been a huge change for me coming into the gardening world, because I've got my own business now selling seeds for these flowers, and I've just been shocked by like people who are essentially my competitors who are doing a similar thing, just sharing information. Everyone's helpful. Everyone kind of wants everyone to succeed. It's such a beautiful community.
Flowers and growing things bring out the best in people, eh? So that's so nice.
Yeah.
Now,
there's loads of information out there if you want to spend the time digging.
But for this book, the way the content is organised is just For listeners, just run them through this idea of the sections in your book, because it's quite, you know, it's quite telling for what they can expect when they buy the book, the way you've got the sections organised.
So the first, I guess, couple of chapters is really about the right back to the basics, you know, like how much space are you going to need? What time is it going to take? What soil, basic soil conditions, how you can plan a year around in your garden. It's really all that kind of foundational information about what you need to do, what you need to think about, how you can improve your soil. And then it moves into kind of making it happen, you know, like how you can grow things. Do you grow from seed? Do you go from seedling? What's a bulb? What's a tuber? How can you plant those? So, and then it is, yeah, the year plan, the calendar, working out your timings. And kind of the bulk of the book, I guess, is, I call it Meet the Family, and there is all the different types of flowers and foliage
that was a question for me. There's your flower topology, the focal stars, the co-stars, the fillers, the fun, and the foliage. And this Meet the Family, you've got this kind of topology. Talk to us about how you came up with that.
Well, that was probably from a lot of research from a lot of flower farmers and learning about how you set out a bouquet. So originally I was going to do it spring, summer, autumn, winter. But then I started setting out that way, and I found it was actually really challenging because some flowers will flower for two seasons. You know, they'll start in summer and carry kind of right to the end of autumn, or winter, you have a very sad little section. So I just found seasons, and everyone's seasons are different. Like for me, when I'm growing some flowers, you know, that's kind of finished in Northland. Southland hasn't started. So it was quite a difficult thing for me, the season. So I thought, actually, what's a more logical way for me is how you set out a bouquet and how you fill that, you know, your focal or your big main flowers that you center it around. And you've got your little filler bits, your funds, your kind of quirky little random pieces, like it might be like an echinops, which looks like a thistle.
But not a pumpkin.
No, not, but there's no vegetables in here.
You know, just saying, we're not American.
No, but that's, I guess, the thought process behind that was so people could start viewing what they're growing as a bouquet.
Yeah, which works really well. So because it is all about growing the flowers, producing the flowers to be in the vase. And the whole theme of the book is around that. Well, have you ever encountered kind of like productive garden snobbery or old school attitudes, like space that can be cultivated is for food production? Have you encountered a kind of snobbery around growing cut flowers?
No, not really, to be honest.
Okay.
No, it's all, I guess maybe I am just so immersed in that world that everyone I'm kind of talking to does grow a lot of flowers. I think maybe more it's surprised people in that it's quite a different way if you're just a traditional gardener, and you might have a few, like maybe a rose here or there in your garden, and then you have your vegetable patch. And it's a different way of viewing flowers, because I don't actually cut flowers out of my main garden, because I do like to view them in the garden and don't want holes in there. So I grow my flowers. In saying that, I will cut the odd hydrangea out of the garden. But my cut flowers, I have in raised vegetable beds that you'd normally have vegetables, and grow them in that manner, that they are a crop that you're harvesting. And I think people will be surprised at how little space you actually need. It's not much space to grow loads of flowers.
And they're great from a pollinator's point of view. So you don't talk about kind of mixing up your flowers and your vegetables. But I know maybe that's a collab that you could do in the future. Yes. Olivia, in Christchurch, it's the kind of wet morning here that bends all the flowers to the ground, right? It's late spring, so they're flowering, but they're all been exposes the extent of the chickweed that's usually hidden there by heavy overplanting. Okay, and it's generally that morning is tomorrow. It's going to be warm, and so I'll get some kind of fungal and bug infestation. Now you say you can help anyone, but is there in that there is kind of like this underlying discipline required, isn't there? You know, plants don't love stupid places, and you can't just plant and then forget completely.
No.
So just to make us feel better, tell us about your most despondent garden moment.
Oh, there's so many. So many. My probably worst moments always, because in Tauranga, I always envy the south when I come because I think things grow slower there. Mm. You know, you do get colder where you look away and you have a jungle in a week. So I think probably mine is always at the end of the 6-week long school holidays. So I've got children home, we're busy, and I come back. And this year it got so bad where I grew in my gardens that my husband was like, "You've really let this one go this year." And it was so bad. I just was like, "Well, we'll just get the weed whacker out."
Oh,
and we
weed-whacked
it down and mowed over the garden and just started again. So,
radical, radical.
But that's what's nice about gardening, you know, like you can just pack it all off.
Start again. That's beautiful.
Sometimes it's easier.
That should make the rest of us feel so much better. Thank you, Olivia. Now, listeners, this is a very, very visually pleasing book. It's velvety matte pages. They give a slightly dreamy, soft focus to all the gorgeous images. It's Potten and Burton, so that's just as you would expect. It's called The Floral Dream. It's written by Olivia McCord, who knows what she is talking about and makes it sound easy. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Olivia.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.